equals the annual needs of a town of 20,000 people. During droughts, flour factories with production quotas stick siphons into Lake Naivasha, a papyrus-lined freshwater bird and hippo sanctuary just downstream from the Aberdars. Along with water, they suck up entire generations of fish eggs. What trickles back whiffs of the chemical trade-off that keeps the bloom on a rose flawless all the way to Paris. Lake Naivasha, however, doesn't look quite so alluring. Phosphates and nitrates leached from flower greenhouses have spread mats of oxygen-choking water hyacinth across its surface. As the lake level drops, water hyacinth, a South American perennial that invaded Africa as a potted plant, crawls ashore, beating back the papyrus. The rotting tissues of hippo carcasses reveal the secret to perfect bouquets: DDT, and 40 times more toxic, dieldrin. Pesticides banned in countries whose markets have made Kenya the world's number one rose exporter. Long after humans and even animals or roses go, dieldrin, an ingeniously stable manufactured molecule, may still be around. No fence, not even one packing 6,000 volts, can ultimately contain the animals of the Aberdars. Their populations will either burst the barriers or wither as their gene pools shrink, until a single virus snuffs an entire species. If humans are snuffed first, however, the fence will stop dispensing jolts. Baboons and elephants will make an afternoon fete of the grains and vegetables in the surrounding Kikuyu shambas. Only coffee stands a chance to survive. Wildlife don't crave caffeine very much. And the Arabica strains brought long ago from Ethiopia liked central Kenya's volcanic soil so much, they've gone native. Wind will shred the polyethylene greenhouse covers, their polymers embrittled by equatorial ultraviolet rays, whose potency is abetted by the flower industry's favorite fumigant, methyl bromide, the most potent ozone destroyer of all. The roses and carnations, addicted to chemicals, will starve, although water hyacinth may outlast everything. The Aberdars forest will pour through the deactivated fence, repossessing shambas and overrunning an old colonial relic below, the Aberdars Country Club. Its fairways currently kept trimmed by resident warthogs. Only one thing stands in the forest's way from reconnecting the wildlife corridors up to Mount Kenya and down to the Samburu Desert: a ghost of the British Empire in the form of eucalyptus groves. Among the myriad species loosed on the world by humans that have surged beyond control, eucalyptus joins ailanthus and kudzu as encroachers that will bedevil the land long after we've departed. To power steam locomotives, the British often replaced slow-maturing tropical hardwood forests with fast-growing eucalyptus from their Australian crown colonies. The aromatic eucalyptus oils that we use to make cough medicine and to disinfect household surfaces kill germs because in larger doses they're toxins meant to chase off competitive plants. Few insects will live around eucalyptus, and with little to eat, few birds nest among them. Lusty drinkers, eucalypti go wherever there's water, such as along Shamba irrigation ditches, where they've formed tall hedgerows. Without people, they'll aim to colonize deserted fields, and they'll have a head start on the native seeds blowing down the mountain. In the end, it may take a great natural African lumberjack, the elephant, to blaze a trail back to Mount Kenya and expel the last British spirits from the land for good. 2. Africa After Us. In an Africa without humans, as elephants push above the equator through Samburu and then beyond the Sahel, they may find a Sahara desert in northward retreat as desertification advance troops, goats, become lunch for lions. Or they may collide with it as temperatures rising on a wave of a human legacy, elevated atmospheric carbon, quicken its march. That the Sahara has lately advanced so rapidly and alarmingly, in places 2 to 3 miles per year, owes to unfortunate timing. Only 6,000 years ago, what is now the world's largest nonpolar desert, was green savanna. Crocodiles and hippos wallowed in plentiful Sahara streams. Then Earth's orbit underwent one of its periodic readjustments. Our tilted axis straightened not even half a degree, but enough to nudge rain clouds around. That alone was not sufficient to turn grasslands to sand dunes. But the coincidence of human progress tipped what was becoming an arid shrubland over a climatic edge. During two previous millennia in North Africa, Homo sapiens had gone from hunting with spears to growing Middle Eastern grains and raising livestock. They mounted their belongings and themselves on newly tamed descendants of an American ungulate that luckily emigrated before its cousins back home perished in a megafaunal holocaust, the camel. Camels eat grass. Grass needs water. So did their masters' crops, whose bounty begat a population boom of humans. More humans needed more herds, pasture, fields, and more water. All at just the wrong time. No one could have known that the rains had shifted. So people and their flocks ranged farther and grazed harder, assuming that the weather would return to what it had been, and that everything would grow back the way it was. It didn't. The more they consumed, the less moisture transpired skyward, and the less it rained. The result was the hot Sahara we see today. Only it used to be smaller. Over this past century, the numbers of Africa's humans and their animals have been rising, and now temperatures are too. This leaves the precarious sub-Saharan tier of Sahel countries at the brink of sliding into the sand. Farther south, equatorial Africans have herded animals for several thousand years and hunted them even longer. Yet between wildlife and humans, there was actually mutual benefit. As pastoralists, such as Kenya's Maasai, shepherded cattle among pastures and waterholes, their spears ready to discourage lions, wildebeest tagged along to take advantage of the predator protection. They, in turn, were followed by their zebra companions. The nomads economized by eating meat sparingly, learning to live on their flock's milk and blood, which they drew by carefully tapping and staunching their cattle's jugular veins. Only when drought reduced fodder for their herds did they fall back on hunting, or trade with bushman tribes that still lived off game. This balance among humans, flora, and fauna first began to shift when humans became prey themselves, or rather, commodities. Like our kin, the chimpanzees, we'd always murdered one another over territory and mates. But with the rise of slavery, we were reduced to something new, an export crop. The mark that slavery left on Africa can be seen today in southeastern Kenya, in brushy country known as Tsavo, an eerie landscape of lava flows, flat-topped tortoise acacias, myrrh, and baobab trees. Because Tsavo's tsetse flies discovered cattle herding, it remained a hunting ground for Wata bushmen. Their game included elephant, giraffe, Cape buffalo, assorted gazelles, clipspringer, and another striped antelope, the kudu, its horns corkscrewing for an amazing 6 feet. The destination for black slaves in East Africa was not America, but Arabia. Until the mid-19th century, Mombasa on Kenya's coast was the shipping port for human flesh. The end of a long line for Arab slavers who captured their merchandise at gunpoint in Central African villages. Caravans of slaves marched barefoot down from the rift, herded by armed captors mounted on donkeys. As they descended into Tsavo, the heat rose and tsetse flies swarmed. Slavers, shooters, and whichever prisoners had survived the journey made for a fig-shaded oasis, Mzima Springs. Its artesian pools, filled with terrapins and hippopotamuses, were refreshed daily by 50 million gallons of water upwelling from porous volcanic hills 30 miles away. For days, slave caravans paused here, paying Wata bow hunters to replenish their stores. The slave route was also the ivory route, and every elephant encountered was harvested. As demand for ivory grew, its price outstripped that of slaves, who became chiefly valued as ivory porters. Near Mzima Springs, the water outcropped again, forming the Tsavo River, which eventually led to the sea. With shady groves of fever trees and palms, this route was irresistible, but the price was often malaria. Jackals and hyenas followed the caravans, and Tsavo's lions developed reputations as man-eaters by dining on dying slaves left behind. Until the late 19th century, when the British ended slavery, thousands of elephants and humans perished along the ivory slave route between the Central Plains and Mombasa's auction block. As the slave trade closed, construction commenced on a railroad between Mombasa and Lake Victoria, a source of the Nile critical to British colonial control. Tsavo's hungry lions gained international fame for devouring railway workers, sometimes leaping aboard trains to corner them. Their appetites became the stuff of legend and movies, which usually failed to mention that their hunger owed to a scarcity of other game, slaughtered to feed a thousand-year cavalcade of enslaved human cargo. After slavery and rail construction, Tsavo was an abandoned, empty country. Without people, its wildlife began creeping back. Briefly, so did armed humans. From 1914 to 1918, Britain and Germany, which had previously agreed to carve up much of Africa between them, were fighting a great war for reasons that seemed even murkier in Africa than in Europe. A battalion of German colonists from Tanganyika, today Tanzania, blew up the British Mombasa-Victoria Railroad on several occasions. The two sides engaged each other amid palms and fever trees along the Tsavo River, living on bushmeat and dying of malaria as much as from bullets. But bullets having the usual disastrous repercussions for wildlife. Again, Tsavo was emptied. Again, in the absence of humans, it filled with animals. Sandpaper trees laden with yellow saucer berries overgrew the World War I battlefields, hosting families of baboons. In 1948, stating that people had no other use for it, the Crown declared Tsavo, one of human history's busiest trade routes, a wilderness refuge. 2 decades later, its elephant population was 45,000, one of Africa's biggest. That, however, was not to last. As the white single-engine Cessna takes off, one of the Earth's most incongruous sights unfolds beneath its wings. The wide savanna below is Nairobi National Park, where elands, Thompson's gazelles, Cape buffalo, hartebeest, ostriches, white-bellied bustards, giraffes, and lions live jammed against a wall of blocky high-rises. Behind that gray urban facade begins one of the world's largest, poorest slums. Nairobi is only as old as the railroad that needed a depot between Mombasa and Victoria. One of the youngest cities on Earth, it will likely be among the first to go, because even new construction here quickly begins to crumble. On its opposite end, Nairobi National Park is unfenced. The Cessna passes its unmarked boundary, crossing into a gray plain dotted with morning glory trees. Through here, the park's migrating wildebeest, zebra, and rhinos follow seasonal rains along a corridor lately pinched by maize fields, flower farms, eucalyptus plantations, and sprawling new fenced estates with private wells and conspicuous large houses. Together, these may turn Kenya's oldest national park into yet another wildlife island. The corridor isn't protected. With real estate outside of roiling Nairobi becoming increasingly attractive, the best option, in the opinion of the Cessna's pilot, David Western, is for the government to pay owners to let animals cross their property. He's helped with negotiations, but he's not hopeful. Everyone fears elephants squashing their gardens, or worse. Counting elephants is David Western's project today, something he has done continually for nearly 3 decades. Raised in Tanzania, son of a British big game hunter, As a boy, he often hiked alongside his gun-toting father for days without seeing another human. The first animal he shot was his last. The look in the dying warthog's eyes cooled any further passion to hunt. After an elephant fatally gored his father, his mother took her children to the comparative safety of London. David stayed through university studies in zoology, then returned to Africa. An hour southeast of Nairobi, Kilimanjaro appears, its shrinking snowcap dripping butterscotch under the rising sun. Just before it, verdant swamps burst from a brown alkaline basin, fed by springs from the volcano's rainy slopes. This is Amboseli, one of Africa's smallest, richest parks, an obligatory pilgrimage for tourists hoping to photograph elephants silhouetted against Kilimanjaro. That used to be a dry season event, when wildlife would pack into Amboseli's marshland oasis to survive on cattails and sedges. Now they're always here. "Elephants aren't supposed to be sedentary," Western mutters as he passes over dozens of females and calves, wading not far from a pod of mucking hippos. From high above, the plain surrounding the park seems infected by giant spores. These are bomas, rings of mud and dung huts belonging to Maasai pastoralists, some occupied, some abandoned and melting back into the earth. A defensive ring of stacked, thorny acacia branches encircles each. The bright green patch in every compound center is where the nomadic Maasai keep cattle safe from predators at night before moving their herds and families to the next pasture. As Maasai move out, elephants move in. Since people first brought cattle down from northern Africa after the Sahara dried, a choreography has evolved featuring elephants and livestock. After cattle chew savanna grasses down, woody shrubs invade. Soon they're tall enough for elephants to munch, using their tusks to strip and eat bark, knocking trees over to reach their tender canopies, clearing the way for grass to return. As a graduate student, David Western sat atop an Amboseli hill, counting cows led to graze by Maasai herders as elephants plodded in the opposite direction to browse. The census he began here of cattle, elephants, and people has never stopped during his subsequent careers as Amboseli Park Director, head of the Kenya Wildlife Service, and founder of the nonprofit African Conservation Center, which works to preserve wildlife habitats by accommodating, not banning, humans who have traditionally shared them. Dropping to 300 feet, he begins flying wide clockwise circles, banked at a 30-degree angle. He tallies a ring of dung-plastered huts, one hut per wife. Some wealthy Maasai have as many as 10 wives. He calculates the approximate number of inhabitants and notes 77 cattle on his vegetation map. What looked from above like blood drops on a green plain turns out to be the Maasai herders themselves. Tall, lithe, dark men in traditional red plaid shoulder cloaks. Traditional, at least, since the 19th century, when Scottish missionaries distributed tartan blankets that Maasai herdsmen found both warm and light enough to carry as they followed their herds for weeks. "The pastoralists," Western shouts over the engine noise, "have become a surrogate migratory species. They behave much like wildebeest." Like the wildebeest, Maasai herd their cows into short grass savannas during wet seasons and bring them back to waterholes when the rains stop. Over a year, Amboseli's Maasai live in an average of 8 settlements. Such human movement, Western is convinced, has literally landscaped Kenya and Tanzania to the benefit of wildlife. "They graze their cattle and leave behind woodland for elephants. In time, elephants create grassland again. You get a patchy mosaic of grass, woods, and shrublands. That's the whole reason for the savanna's diversity. If you only had woodlands or grasslands, you would only support woodland species or grassland species." In 1999, Western described this to paleoecologist Paul Martin, father of the Pleistocene overkill extinction theory, while driving through southern Arizona en route to see where Clovis people finished off local mammoths 13,000 years earlier. Since that time, the American Southwest had evolved without big herbivore browsers. Martin gestured at the tangle of mesquite sprouting on public lands that ranchers leased, which they were always begging permission to burn. "Do you think this could work as elephant habitat?" he asked. At the time, David Western laughed. But Martin persisted. How would African elephants do in this desert? Would they be able to ascend the craggy granite mountain ranges to find water? Might Asian elephants do better, since they were more closely related to mammoths? It's surely better than using a bulldozer and herbicides to get rid of mesquite, Western agreed. Elephants would do it a lot more cheaply and simply, and they also spread manure around for grass seedlings. Exactly, said Martin, what mammoths and mastodons did. Sure, Western replied. Why not use an ecological surrogate species if you don't have the original ones there? Ever since, Paul Martin has been campaigning to return elephants to North America. Unlike Maasai, however, American ranchers aren't nomads who regularly vacate niches for elephants to use. Increasingly, though, Maasai and their cows are also staying put. The barren, overgrazed ground ringing Amboseli National Park testifies to the result. When light-haired, fair-skinned David Western, of medium height, chats in Swahili with 7-foot ebony Maasai herdsmen, the contrast dissolves in long-standing mutual regard. Land subdivision has long been their common foe, but with developers and immigrants from rival tribes putting up fences and staking claims, the Maasai have no choice but to seek title and cling to their lands as well. The new human use pattern reshaping Africa may not be easily obliterated when humans are gone, says Western. It's a bipolar situation. When you force elephants inside a park and you graze cattle outside, you get two very different habitats. Inside, you lose all your trees and it becomes grasslands. Outside, it becomes thick bushlands. During the 1970s and 1980s, elephants learned the hard way to stay where they're safe. Unwittingly, they lumbered into a global collision between deepening African poverty, which in Kenya was yoked to the planet's highest birth rate, and the boom that spawned the so-called Asian economic tigers, which unleashed a craving in the Far East for luxuries. These included ivory. The desire for it outstripped even the lust that once financed centuries of slavery. As the price, $20 per kilo, rose by a factor of 10, ivory poachers turned places like Tsavo into a trash heap of tuskless carcasses. By the 1980s, more than half of Africa's 1.3 million elephants were dead. Only 19,000 were left in Kenya, packed into sanctuaries such as Amboseli. International ivory bans and shoot-to-kill orders for poachers calmed but never eradicated the carnage, especially the slaughter of elephants outside parks on the pretext of defending crops or people. The fever tree acacias that once lined Amboseli swamps are now gone, downed by overcrowded pachyderms. As parks become treeless plains, desert creatures like gazelles and oryx replace browsers like giraffes, kudus, and bushbuck. It is a man-made replica of extreme drought, such as Africa knew during ice ages, when habitats shriveled and creatures crammed into oases. Africa's megafauna made it through those bottlenecks. But David Western fears what may happen to them in this one, stranded on island refuges in a sea of settlements, subdivisions, exhausted pastures, and factory farms. For thousands of years, migratory humans were their escorts across Africa, nomads and their herds taking what they needed and moving on, leaving nature even richer in their wake. But now such human migration is coming to a close. Homo sedentarian has flipped that scenario. Food now migrates to us, along with luxury goods and other consumables that never existed through most of human history. Unlike anywhere else on Earth, save Antarctica, where people never settled, Africa alone has not suffered a major wildlife extinction. But intensified agriculture and high human population, Western worries, mean that we're looking at one now. The balance that evolved between humans and wildlife in Africa has tipped out of control. Too many people, too many cows, too many elephants stuffed into too few spaces by too many poachers. The hope that sustains David Western lies in knowing that some of Africa is still as it was, before we evolved into a keystone species potent enough to push even elephants around. If there were no people left, he believes, Africa, which has been occupied by humans longer than any other place, would paradoxically revert to the purest primeval state on Earth. With so much wildlife grazing and browsing, Africa is the only continent where exotic plants haven't escaped suburban gardens to usurp the countryside. But Africa after people would include some key changes. Once, North African cattle were wild. But after thousands of years with humans, says Western, they've been selected for a gut like an oversized fermentation vat to eat huge amounts of forage during the day because they can't graze at night. So now they're not very quick. Left on their own, they'd be rather vulnerable prime beef. And a lot of it. Cattle now account for more than half the live weight of Africa's savanna ecosystems. Without Maasai spears to protect them, they would provide an orgy for binging lions and hyenas. Once cows were gone, there would be more than double the feed for everything else. Shading his eyes, Western leans against his jeep and calculates what the new numbers would mean. 1.5 million wildebeest can take out grass just as effectively as cattle. You'd see much tighter interaction between them and elephants. They would play the role the Maasai refer to when they say that cattle grow trees, elephants grow grass. As for elephants without people, Darwin estimated 10 million elephants in Africa. That was actually quite close to what was here before the big ivory trade. He turns to look at the female herd sloshing in the Amboseli swamp. At the moment, we have 500,000. No people and 20 times more elephants would restore them as the undisputed keystone species in a patchwork mosaic African landscape. By contrast, in North and South America, for 13,000 years, nearly no creatures except insects have eaten tree bark and bushes. After mammoths died, enormous forests would spread unless farmers cleared them, ranchers burned them, peasants cut them for fuel, or developers bulldozed them. Without humans, American forests represent vast niches awaiting any herbivore big enough to extract their woody nutrients. 3. Insidious Epitaph. Partois Ole Santian heard the story often when he was growing up, wandering with his father's cows west of Amboseli. He listens respectfully as Kasi Kunyi, the gray old man living with his three wives in a boma in Masai Mara, where Santian now works, tells it again. In the beginning, when there was only forest, Ngai gave us bushmen to hunt for us. But then the animals moved away, too far to be hunted. The Maasai prayed to Ngai to give us an animal that wouldn't move away, and he said, "Wait 7 days." Kunyi takes a hide strap and holds one end of it skyward to demonstrate a ramp sweeping down to earth. Cattle came down from heaven, and everyone said, "Look at that! Our God is so kind. He sent us such a beautiful beast. It has milk, beautiful horns, and different colors. Not like wildebeest or buffalo with only one color." At this point, the story gets sticky. The Maasai claim all the cattle are meant for them and kick the bushmen out of their bomas. When the bushmen ask Ngai for their own cattle to feed themselves, he refuses, but offers them the bow and arrow. That's why they still hunt in the forests instead of herding like we Maasai. Kunyi grins. his wide eyes glowing red in afternoon sun that flashes off the pendulous cone-shaped bronze earrings that stretch his lobes chinward. The Maasai, he explains, figured out how to burn trees to create savannas for their herds. The fires also smoked out malarial mosquitoes. Santian gets his drift. When humans were mere hunter-gatherers, we weren't much different from any other animal. Then we were chosen by God to become pastoralists, with divine dominion over the best animals, and our blessings grew. The trouble is, Santian also knows, the Maasai didn't stop there. Even after white colonials took so much grazing land, nomadic life had still worked. But Maasai men each took at least 3 wives, and as each wife bore 5 or 6 children, she needed about 100 cows to support them. Such numbers were bound to catch up with them. In Santian's young lifetime, he has seen round bomas become keyhole-shaped as Maasai appended fields of wheat and corn and began to stay in one place to tend them. Once they became agriculturalists, everything began to change. Partois Ole Santian, who grew up in a modernizing Maasai generation with the option of studying, excelled in sciences, learned English and French, and became a naturalist. At 26, he became one of a handful of Africans to earn silver certification from the Kenya Professional Safari Guide Association, the highest level. He found work with an ecotourism lodge in the Kenyan extension of Tanzania's Serengeti Plain, Maasai Mara, a park combining an animals-only reserve with mixed conservation areas where Maasai, their herds, and wildlife might coexist as they always have. The red oatgrass Maasai Mara Plain, dotted with desert date and flat-topped acacias, is still as splendid a savanna as any in Africa, except that the most predominant animal grazing here is now the cow. Often, Santian ties leather shoes on his long legs and climbs Kileleoni Hill, the highest point in the Mara. It is still wild enough to find impala carcasses hanging from tree limbs where leopards have stored them. From the top, Santian can look 60 miles south into Tanzania and the immense green grass sea of the Serengeti. There, honking wildebeest mill in huge June flocks that will soon merge like floodwaters and burst across the border, bounding through rivers that boil with crocodiles awaiting their annual northward migration, with lions and leopards dozing above in the tortoise trees, needing only to roll over to make a kill. The Serengeti has long been an object of Maasai bitterness. 500,000 square kilometers from which they were swept away in 1951 for a theme park cleansed of a keystone species, Homo sapiens, to humor Hollywood-bred tourist delusions of Africa as wilderness primeval. But Maasai naturalists like Santian are now grateful for it. The Serengeti, blessed with perfect volcanic soils for grassland, is gene bank to the richest concentration of mammals on Earth, a source from which species might one day radiate and repopulate the rest of the planet, if it comes to that. Huge as it is, however, naturalists worry about how the Serengeti will maintain all those uncountable gazelles, let alone elephants, if everything surrounding it turns into farms and fences. There isn't enough rain to change all the savanna into arable farmland, but that hasn't stopped the Maasai from multiplying. So far married to only one woman, Partois Ole Santian decided to stop right there. But Nunkokwa, the childhood girlfriend he wed upon completing his traditional warrior training, was horrified to learn that she might be in this marriage alone, with no female companions. "I'm a naturalist," he explained to her. "If all the wildlife habitat disappeared, I'd have to farm." Before subdividing began, Maasai considered farming beneath the dignity of men chosen by God to pasture cattle. They wouldn't even break sod to bury someone. Nunkokwa understood, but she was still a Maasai woman. They compromised at 2 wives, but she still wanted 6 children. He was hoping to hold it to 4. The second wife, of course, would want some too. Only one thing, too terrible to contemplate, might slow all this proliferating before all the animals go extinct. The old man, Kunyi, had said it himself. The end of the earth, he called it. In time, AIDS will wipe out humans. The animals will take it all back. AIDS isn't yet the nightmare for the Maasai that it has become for sedentary tribes. But Santian saw how it could be soon. Once, Maasai only traveled on foot through savannas with their cows, spear in hand. Now, some go to towns, sleep with whores, and spread AIDS on their return. Even worse are the lorry drivers who now show up twice a week, bringing gasoline for the pickups, motor scooters, and tractors that Maasai farmers purchase. Even young uncircumcised girls are getting infected. In non-Maasai areas, such as up at Lake Victoria, where the Serengeti animals migrate each year, coffee growers too sick with AIDS to groom their plants have turned to growing easy staples like bananas or cutting trees to make charcoal. Coffee bushes, now feral, are 15 feet high, beyond rehabilitation. Santian has heard people say they don't care anymore, there's no cure, so they won't stop having children. So orphans now live with a virus instead of with parents, in villages where the adults have been all but wiped out. Houses with no one left alive are collapsing. Mudstick huts with dung roofs have melted away, leaving only half-finished houses of brick and cement begun by traders with money made from driving their lorries. Then they got sick and gave their money to herbalists to cure them and their girlfriends. Nobody got well, and construction never resumed. The herbalists got all the money, then got sick themselves. In the end, the traders died, the girlfriends died, the medicine men died, and the money vanished. All that remains are roofless houses with acacias growing in the middle, and infected children who sell themselves to survive until they die early. It's wiping out a generation of future leaders, Santian had replied to Kunyi that afternoon. But the old Maasai figured that future leaders wouldn't matter much with animals back in charge. The sun rolls along the Serengeti plain, filling the sky with iridescence. As it falls over the edge, blue twilight settles on the savanna. The day's remaining warmth floats up the side of Kililione Hill and dissolves into the dusk. The chilly updraft that follows carries the screech of baboons. Santian pulls his red and yellow tartan shuka tighter. Could AIDS be the animal's final revenge? If so, pan troglodytes, our chimpanzee siblings in Central Africa's womb, are accessories to our undoing. The human immunodeficiency virus that infects most people is closely related to a simian strain that chimps carry without getting sick. The less common HIV-2 is similar to a form carried by rare manga bee monkeys found in Tanzania. Infection probably spread to humans through bushmeat. On encountering the 4% of our genes that differ from the genes of our closest primate relations, the virus mutated lethally. Had moving to the savannah somehow made us biochemically more vulnerable? Santian can identify every mammal, bird, reptile, tree, and spider, and most flowers, visible insects, and medicinal plants in this ecosystem. But some subtle genetic differences escape him, and everyone's searching for an AIDS vaccine as well. The answer may be in our brain, since brain size is where humans differ significantly from chimps and bonobos. Another burst of yakking from the baboon troop drifts up from below. Probably they're harassing the leopard who hung the impala meat. Interesting how male baboons vying for alpha status have learned to maintain a truce long enough to cooperate in discouraging leopards. Baboons also have the largest brain of any primate after Homo sapiens, and are the only other primate that adapted to living in savannas as forest habitats shrank. If the dominant ungulates of the savanna, cattle, disappear, wildebeest will expand to take their place. If humans vanish, will baboons move into ours? Has their cranial capacity lay suppressed during the Holocene because we got the jump on them, being first out of the trees? With us no longer in the way, will their mental potential surge to the occasion and push them into a sudden, punctuated evolutionary scramble into every cranny of our vacant niche? Santian rises and stretches. A new moon rocks toward the equatorial horizon, its points curving upward like a bowl for silvery Venus to settle inside. The Southern Cross and Milky Way assume their places. The air smells like violets. Up here, Santian hears wood owls, like those he knew in his boyhood, until the forests around their bomas turn to wheat fields. If human crops revert to a mosaic of woods and grassland, and if baboons fill our keystone slot, would they be satisfied to dwell in pure natural beauty? Or would curiosity and sheer narcissistic delight in their unfolding powers eventually push them and their planet to the brink, too? Part 2. Chapter 7. What Falls Apart. In the summer of 1976, Alan Cavender got a call he wasn't expecting. The Constantia Hotel in Varosha was reopening under a new name after standing vacant for nearly 2 years. A lot of electrical work was needed. Was he available? This was a surprise. Varosha, a resort on the eastern shore of the Mediterranean island of Cyprus, had been off-limits to everyone since war fractured the country 2 years earlier. The actual fighting had lasted only a month before the United Nations stepped in to broker a messy truce between Turkish and Greek Cypriots. A no-man's zone called the Green Line was drawn wherever opposing troops found themselves at the exact moment of the ceasefire. In the capital, Nicosia, the Green Line wandered like a drunk among bullet-scarred avenues and houses. On narrow streets where hand-to-hand combat had been underway between enemies jabbing bayonets from facing balconies, it was little more than 10 feet wide. In the country, it broadened to 5 miles. Turks now lived to the north, and Greeks to the south of a weedy UN-patrolled strip, refuge to hares and partridges. When the war broke out in 1974, much of Varosha was barely 2 years old. Strung along a sand crescent south of the deepwater port of Famagusta, a walled city dating to 2000 BC, Varosha had been developed by Greek Cypriots as Cyprus's Riviera. By 1972, tall hotels extended 3 uninterrupted miles along Varosha's golden beach, backed by blocks of shops, restaurants, cinemas, vacation bungalows, and employee housing. The location had been chosen for the gentle, warm waters on the island's wind-sheltered eastern coast. The sole flaw was the decision, repeated by nearly every beachfront high-rise, to build as close to shore as possible. Too late, they realized that once the sun peaked at noon, the beach would lie in a shadow cast by the palisade of hotels. There wasn't much time to worry about that, though. In the summer of 1974, war flared, and when it halted a month later, Varosha's Greek Cypriots saw their grand investment end up on the Turkish side of the Green Line. They and all Varosha's residents had to flee south to the Greek side of the island. About the size of Connecticut, mountainous Cyprus floats in a placid aquamarine sea ringed by several countries whose genetically intertwined peoples often detest each other. Ethnic Greeks arrived on Cyprus some 4,000 years ago, and subsequently lived under a parade of conquering Assyrians, Phoenicians, Persians, Romans, Arabs, Byzantines, English Crusaders, French, and Venetians. The year 1570 brought yet another conqueror, the Ottoman Empire. With it came Turkish settlers, who by the 20th century would comprise slightly less than 1/5 of the island's population. After World War I finished off the Ottomans, Cyprus ended up as a British colony. The island's Greeks, Orthodox Christians who had periodically revolted against the Ottoman Turks weren't thrilled to have British rulers instead, and clamored for unification with Greece. The Turkish Cypriot Muslim minority protested. Tensions boiled for decades and erupted viciously several times during the 1950s. A 1960 compromise resulted in the independent Republic of Cyprus, with power shared between Greeks and Turks. Ethnic hatred, however, had by then become a habit. Greeks massacred entire Turkish families, and Turks ferociously avenged them. A military takeover in Greece detonated a coup on the island, midwifed by the American CIA in honor of Greece's new anti-communist rulers. That prompted Turkey in July 1974 to send troops to protect Turkish Cypriots from being annexed by Greece. During the ensuing brief war, each side was accused of inflicting atrocities on the other's civilians. When the Greeks placed anti-aircraft guns atop a high-rise in the seaside resort of Varosha, Turkish bombers attacked in American-made jets, and Varosha's Greeks ran for their lives. Alan Cavender, a British electrical engineer, had arrived on the island 2 years earlier in 1972. He had been taking assignments with a London firm throughout the Middle East, and when he saw Cyprus, he decided to stay. Except for torrid July and August, the island's weather was mostly mild and spotless. He settled on the northern shore, below mountains where yellow limestone villages lived off the harvests of olive and carob trees, which they exported from an inlet harbor at its town, Kyrenia. When the war began, he decided to wait it out, figuring correctly that there would be demand for his expertise when it ended. He wouldn't have predicted the call from the hotel, however. After the Greeks abandoned Varosha, the Turkish Cypriots, rather than let squatters colonize it, decided that the fancy resort would be more valuable as a bargaining chip when negotiations for a permanent reconciliation got underway. So they built a chain-link fence around it, strung barbed wire across the beach, stationed Turkish soldiers to guard it, and posted signs warning everyone else away. After 2 years, however, an old Ottoman foundation that owned property that included the northernmost Varosha Hotel requested permission to refurbish and reopen it. It was a sensible idea, Cavender could see. The four-story hotel, to be renamed the Palm Beach, sat far enough back on a shoreline bend that its terrace and beachfront remained sunny through the afternoon. The hotel tower next door, which had briefly held a Greek machine gun placement, had collapsed during the Turkish bombing raid. But aside from its rubble, everything else Alan Cavender found when he first entered the zone seemed intact. Eerily so. He was struck by how quickly humans had abandoned it. The hotel registry was still open to August 1974, when business had suddenly halted. Room keys lay where they'd been tossed on the front desk. Windows facing the sea had been left open, and blowing sand had formed small dunes in the lobby. Flowers had dried in vases. Turkish coffee demitasses and breakfast dishes, licked clean by mice, were still in place on the table linens. His task was to bring the air conditioning system back into service. However, this routine job was proving difficult. The southern Greek portion of the island had UN recognition as the legitimate Cyprus government, but a separate Turkish state in the north was recognized only by Turkey. With no access to spare parts, an arrangement was made with Turkish troops guarding Varosha to allow Cavender to quietly cannibalize whatever he needed from the other vacant hotels. He wandered through the deserted town. About 20,000 people had lived or worked in Varosha. Asphalt and pavement had cracked. He wasn't surprised to see weeds growing in the deserted streets, but hadn't expected to see trees already. Australian wattles, a fast-growing acacia species used by hotels for landscaping, were popping out mid-street, some nearly 3 feet high. Creepers from ornamental succulents snaked out of hotel gardens, crossing roads and climbing tree trunks. Shops still displayed souvenirs and tanning lotion. A Toyota dealership was showing 1974 Corollas and Celicas. Concussions from Turkish Air Force bombs, Cavender saw, had exploded plate glass store windows. Boutique mannequins were half-clothed, their imported fabrics flapping in tattered strips, the dress racks behind them full, but deeply dust-coated. The canvas of baby prams was likewise torn. He hadn't expected to see so many left behind. And bicycles. The honeycombed facades of empty hotels, 10 stories of shattered sliding glass doors opening to sea-view balconies, now exposed to the elements, had become giant pigeon roosts. Pigeon droppings coated everything. Carib rats nested in hotel rooms, living off Jaffa oranges and lemons from former citrus groves that had been absorbed into Varosha's landscaping. The bell towers of Greek churches were spattered with the blood and feces of hanging bats. Sheets of sand blew across avenues and covered floors. What surprised him at first was the general absence of smell, except for a mysterious stench that emanated from hotel swimming pools, most of which were inexplicably drained, yet reeked as though filled with cadavers. Around them, the upturned tables and chairs, torn beach umbrellas, and glasses knocked on their sides, all spoke of some revelry gone terribly wrong. Cleaning all this up was going to be expensive. For 6 months, as he dismantled and rescued air conditioners, industrial washers and dryers, and entire kitchens full of ovens, grills, refrigerators, and freezers, silence pounded at him. It actually hurt his ears, he told his wife. During the year before the war, he'd worked at a British naval base south of town, and would often leave her at a hotel to enjoy a day at the beach. When he picked her up afterward, a dance band would be playing for the German and British tourists. Now no bands, just the incessant kneading of the sea that no longer soothed. The wind sighing through open windows became a whine. The cooing of pigeons grew deafening. The sheer absence of human voices bouncing off walls was unnerving. He kept listening for Turkish soldiers who were under instructions to shoot looters. He wasn't certain how many assigned to patrol knew that he was there legally, or would give him a chance to prove it. It turned out not to be a problem. He seldom saw any guards. He understood why they would avoid entering such a tomb. By the time Metin Munir saw Varosha, 4 years after Alan Cavender's reclamation job ended, roofs had collapsed, and trees were growing straight out of houses. Munir, one of Turkey's best-known newspaper columnists, is a Turkish Cypriot who went to Istanbul to study, came home to fight when the troubles began, then returned to Turkey when the troubles kept going on and on. In 1980, he was the first journalist allowed to enter Varosha for a few hours. The first thing he noticed was shredded laundry still hanging from clotheslines. What struck him most, though, wasn't the absence of life, but its vibrant presence. With the humans who built Varosha gone, nature was intently recouping it. Varosha, merely 60 miles from Syria and Lebanon, is too balmy for a freeze-thaw cycle, but its pavement was tossed asunder anyway. The wrecking crews weren't just trees, Munir marveled, but also flowers. Tiny seeds of wild cypress cyclamen had wedged into cracks, germinated, and heaved aside entire slabs of cement. Streets now rippled with white cyclamen combs and their pretty variegated leaves. "You understand," Munir wrote his readers back in Turkey, "just what the Taoists mean when they say that soft is stronger than hard." 2 more decades passed. The millennium turned and kept going. Once, Turkish Cypriots had bet that Varosha, too valuable to lose, would force the Greeks to the bargaining table. Neither side had dreamed that 30-plus years later, the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus would still exist, severed not only from the Greek Republic of Cyprus, but from the world, still a pariah nation to all except Turkey. Even the UN peacekeeping force was exactly where it was in 1974, still listlessly patrolling the Green Line, occasionally waxing a pair of still-impounded, still-new 1974 Toyotas. Nothing has changed, except Varosha, which is entering advanced stages of decay. Its encircling fence and barbed wire are now uniformly rusted, but there is nothing left to protect but ghosts. An occasional Coca-Cola sign and broadsides posting nightclubs cover charges hang on doorways that haven't seen customers in more than 3 decades, and now never will again. Casement windows have flapped and stayed open, their pocked frames empty of glass. Fallen limestone facing lies in pieces. Hunks of wall have dropped from buildings to reveal empty rooms, their furniture long ago somehow spirited away. Paint has dulled. The underlying plaster, where it remains, has yellowed to muted patinas. Where it doesn't, brick-shaped gaps show where mortar has already dissolved. Other than the back and forth of pigeons, all that moves is the creaky rotor of one last functioning windmill. Hotels, mute and windowless, some with balconies that have fallen, precipitating cascades of damage below, still line the Riviera that once aspired to be Cannes or Acapulco. At this point, all parties agree. None is salvageable. Nothing is. To someday once again lure tourists, Varosha will have to be bulldozed and begun anew. In the meantime, nature continues its reclamation project. Feral geraniums and philodendrons emerge from missing roofs and pour down exterior walls. Flame trees, china berries, and thickets of hibiscus, oleander, and passion lilac sprout from nooks where indoors and outdoors now blend. Houses disappear under magenta mounds of bougainvillea. Lizards and whipsnakes skitter through stands of wild asparagus, prickly pear, and 6-foot grasses. A spreading ground cover of lemongrass sweetens the air. At night, the darkened beachfront, free of moonlight bathers, crawls with nesting loggerhead and green sea turtles. The island of Cyprus is shaped like a skillet, with its long handle extended toward the Syrian shore. Its pan is gridded with 2 mountain ranges oriented east-west and divided by a wide central basin, and by the Green Line, with 1 sierra on each side. The mountains were once covered with Aleppo and Corsican pines, oaks, and cedars. A cypress and juniper forest filled the entire central plain between the 2 ranges. Olive, almond, and carob trees grew on the arid seaward slopes. At the end of the Pleistocene, dwarf elephants the size of cows and pygmy hippopotamuses no bigger than farmyard swine roamed among these trees. Since Cyprus originally rose from the sea, unconnected to the 3 continents that surround it, both species apparently arrived by swimming. They were followed by humans about 10,000 years ago. At least 1 archaeological site suggests that the last pygmy hippo was killed and cooked by Homo sapiens hunters. The trees of Cyprus were prized by Assyrian, Phoenician, and Roman boat builders. During the Crusades, most of them disappeared into the warships of Richard the Lionhearted. By then, the goat population was so large that the plains remained treeless. During the 20th century, plantations of umbrella pines were introduced to try to resuscitate former springs. However, in 1995, following a long drought, nearly all of them and the remaining native forests in the northern mountains exploded in a lightning inferno. Journalist Metin Munir was too grieved to return again from Istanbul to face his native island in ashes, until a Turkish Cypriot horticulturist, Hikmet Ulican, convinced him he needed to see what was happening. Once again, Munir found that flowers were renewing a Cyprus landscape. The burnt hillsides were blanketed with crimson poppies. Some poppy seeds, Ulican told him, live 1,000 years or more, waiting for fire to clear trees away so they can bloom. In the village of Lapta, high above the northern coastline, Hikmet Ulican grows figs, cyclamens, cacti, and grapes, and reverently tends the oldest weeping mulberry in all Cyprus. His mustache, Van Dyke beard, and remaining tufts of hair have whitened since he was forced to leave the South as a young man, where his father had a vineyard and raised sheep, almonds, olives, and lemons. Until the senseless feud that tore apart his island, 20 generations of Greeks and Turks had shared their valley. Then neighbors were clubbed to death. They found the smashed body of an old Turkish woman who had been grazing her goat, the bleeding animal still tied to her wrist. It was barbaric. But Turks were also slaying Greeks. Murderous mutual loathing between tribes was no more explicable or complicated than the genocidal urges of chimpanzees.